going to pick up the pace a bit going through Job, just because there's 42 chapters in the book of Job. Much of it is people speaking foolishly. I don't like to dwell on people speaking foolishly. There's good stuff to be found in Job, don't get me wrong. But it's inherently recorded error in some cases, because you have inherently recorded the mistaken theology of a few guys. And they say it, but just because they say it doesn't make it true. Sometimes it's a misapplication. Sometimes it's completely wrong. You remember the story, Job, we've already covered up through chapter 5 at this point. Job, we're told, was a blameless man, not sinless, but blameless, upright, very rich, 10 children, loved good, loved God, eschewed evil. And then we're given a behind-the-scenes glimpse where God is bragging on Job to Satan, and Satan says, well, let me take his stuff, and he'll curse you to your face. And so God says, you can have at his stuff. And then one day, he caused all of his flocks, all of his herds, all of his possessions, and his 10 children all to be killed the same day. Boom, boom, boom. Job didn't forsake God or sin. Same thing plays out again. This time, Satan says, well, yeah, but you let me touch him, and he'll curse you to your face. And God said, you can do whatever you want to him, just don't kill him. So he hits him with these nasty, festering boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, so that he's sitting in a ash heap scraping himself with broken pottery. And yet still he doesn't sin. And then he has three friends come to talk to him. And they don't say anything for about a week, and they just sit there with him. And then finally, Eliphaz began to speak to him. And in chapters 4 and 5, and Eliphaz says things to him like, you look at chapter 5, verse 1, or verse 2, for wrath killed the foolish man, and for envy slayeth the silly one. I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety, but they are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver them. So Eliphaz basically says, Job, yeah, your kids were all crushed because you were foolish. In verse 12, he basically tells Job that God is disappointing the devices of the crafty. So you've been sneaky, Job. That's why this has happened. In verse 17, he tells Job that he's being corrected by God. And then at the end of chapter 5, verse 27, he says, we have searched it. It is so. So hear it and know that it's for thy good. This is the truth, Job. So we come to chapter 6, and Job responds to Eliphaz. It says, but Job answered and said, oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together. For now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up. He's basically, my words are swallowed up. It gives the impression, if you look at the language underneath, that he's saying, yeah, my words might have been a little hasty in some of the complaining that he did. But he says, you have to understand, I mean, in the suffering I'm going through, of course it colored my world some. He says, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit, the terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. He feels like, as he's been getting hit one after another, like someone's shooting arrows into him, puncture after puncture after puncture. I mean, to have everything you own just taken, 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 finally your 10 children taken, you'd feel like someone was hitting you with arrows. He says, does the wild donkey bray when he hath grass, or loweth the ox over his fodder? You know, the animals don't bellow and complain if they've got food, but when they're empty, when they have nothing, is when they complain. He says, I wasn't complaining for no reason. Look at me. I'm covered with these pussy, boily, scabby, we're going to see wormy things all over me. It's not for no reason that I'm making this noise. He says, can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg? It's like saying, you know, it's just the stuff I've got to eat. It's just bitter. It's just hard to swallow. In fact, he says, the things that my soul refused to touch are as my sorrowful meat. It's like I've been given a big dung burger to eat, and I've got a big manure sandwich and got to bite down hard. I mean, that's what my life is at this point. He says, oh, that I might have my request, and that God would grant me the thing that I long for, even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. Then should I have comfort, yea, I would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. I wish God would just finish me off. I wish I was dead, is what he's saying, you know? And that's, you might have felt that way before. None of us, I think, have had it as hard as Job has it here. Paul had said in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 8, he says, "For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of measure, above strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life." Paul says, hey, when we were in Asia, we wish we were dead. "But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God which raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and doth deliver, in whom we trust that he will yet deliver us." You know, yeah, we wanted to die, but we don't trust our own judgment in thinking it would be better to die. Instead, we trust in God, and he delivered us from that. He's presently delivering us from what we're going through, and we're confident that he will yet deliver us from the things that we're still faced. But Job could say this back in verse 10. He says, "For I have not concealed the words of the Holy One." And if you've got an NIV, it means, "I have not denied." He says, if nothing else, yeah, I've gone through this stuff and I've complained a little bit, but you know what? I never denied the Lord. And I haven't been a hypocrite like Eliphaz just said that I was. Even if he's going to kill me, let him, you know, at least I know that I haven't denied him. He says, "What is my strength that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh of brass? Is not my help in me, and is wisdom driven quite from me? I'm weak. I got a weak flesh. I've got no strength left." And, you know, as the world would tell us, you just need to look deep within yourself because the answers are there. If you just look, you know, look down deep and your conscience, your heart will guide you. Job says, man, if I got to look in myself, I got nothing there. I know better. I mean, I've looked deep enough into myself to say, I don't like what I see. If that's where my hope lies. And Job says, I got nothing. And then he says this to his friends, "To him that is afflicted, pity should be showed from his friend, but he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty." He says to his friends, do you guys even fear God? You know, it's like sometimes, you know, joking around with Josh or someone else, just like, dude, are you even saved? Why would you say something like that? Well, that's basically what he's saying to his friends. He's saying, I just lost my 10 kids. Everything I have, I'm struck with boils. And you come here and you don't show me the smallest amount of pity. You come out here and just trash me. Don't you guys even fear God? "My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook, and as the stream of brooks they pass away, which are blackish by reason of ice and wherein the snow is hid. What time they wax warm, they vanish. When it's hot, they're consumed out of their place. The paths of their way are turned aside. They go to nothing and perish. The troops of Tema looked, the companies of Sheba waited for them. They were confounded because they had hoped. They came thither and were ashamed." He's speaking about the wadis in that part of the world where in the wintertime, they would actually, when there was snow, they would freeze over. And underneath the black ice, you'd see water running down these riverbeds. But as soon as the ice would melt, it just all disappeared. And you'd be left with nothing but a dry riverbed. And he said, you know, my friends were coming. They had the appearance. And he talks about these two different groups, the armies that came there, and were expecting sustenance from that because, well, we know there's water running under there because we can see it. And as soon as the snow melts, they're left with nothing but sand. He says, you guys had the appearance. You're like clouds without rain. You had the appearance of giving some refreshment. And then my friends show up. And then as soon as they open their mouths, there's nothing but sand they're spewing at me. There's no refreshment at all. And then he says, why? He says, "For now you are nothing. You see my casting down and are afraid." What you're seeing right there and what Job noticed is the collapse of the prosperity gospel. Because his friends were holding the position theologically that good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. God rewards those who are good and righteous, and he punishes those who are evil. And so if we see someone going through something hard, it's obviously a result of punishment. So they see their friend Job, who was more blameless and righteous than anybody they could ever imagine. They knew he was always offering sacrifices and all of that. And they see him going through this, and it rocks their world. Because they got two choices at that point. They have to either admit that they're wrong about their worldview. And it's a scary thing to come to the place where you realize the world doesn't operate like I think it operates. Or they have to say, you obviously did something to deserve this, Job. And that's really what they're saying to him. And Eliphaz made, you remember last week, all of these different veiled accusations about whether Job was being deceitful, whether he'd been prideful, whether there was some supernatural revelation that he'd done something wrong. But there was never a specific. There was just, you've sinned, you've done wrong, you just need to repent, you need to pray, you need to go to God. Because they're afraid of the ramifications of what's going on with Job is to their belief system. Job says, you see my casting down and you're afraid. Did I say, bring unto me? Give me a reward for me of your substance, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the mighty? Did I ask you for anything? Did I ask you to come here and give me this? Did I ask you to bail me out, to rescue me? He says, teach me and I'll hold my tongue, and cause me to understand whereof I've erred. Look, forget all of these insinuations that I've done something wrong. Show me where I've sinned. Show me what I did that was wrong. And it's not that Job, I think, because you know, before these friends were ever asking Job and accusing him of doing something wrong, Job was accusing himself, saying, I must have done something to deserve this. Because Job is of the same mindset in a lot of ways, theologically. And he's like, I know I must. God, what did I do? Forgive me. You know, we were told that in the beginning, Job every day would offer sacrifices for his children just in case they had perchance sinned and overlooked something. That's how much he was always trying to do the utmost to keep the law that he knew, the sacrificial system that he knew, and it was before the Levitical system. But and so when stuff started happening to him, and we're told that in all of this he didn't sin, but he continued to speak well of the Lord, he continued, and you know he was offering whatever sacrifices he thought he needed to offer. He was calling out to God, God, whatever I've done wrong, forgive me. And he's got nothing. He doesn't hear an answer. And so now he's saying to these guys, okay, just, you know what, show me. Show me where it is. He says, how forcible are right words? What does your arguing reprove? Do you imagine to reprove words in the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? He says, I cried out in anguish, and you disregarded what I said like I was just blowing hot air. Yea, you overwhelm the fatherless, and you dig a pit for your friend. You're attacking me, trying to trap me to justify your own beliefs. Now, therefore, be content. Look upon me, for it's evident unto you if I lie. Look at me, guys. I am covered with pussy, wormy sores, okay? I mean, look at this. Look at where he is. He says, return, I pray you. Let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again. My righteousness is in it. Is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? Just stop assuming I'm guilty. I know right from wrong. If I had done something wrong, I would have recognized it. I would have known. Now it goes to chapter 7, and Job turns from talking to his friends, and he starts addressing God, and he said, is there not an appointed time to man upon earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hireling? A workman. A hireling is the guy who does labor in the field. And one thing we know, any of you guys who work a regular job, maybe with a slight caveat if you're a salary guy, but by and large, you know your day has a beginning and an end somewhere. And at some point, even if you're a salary guy, they gotta let you go home. There are some labor laws in the state of Maine. They can't force you to sleep there. Yeah, eventually, they have to let you go. But the normal guy knows his hours. He knows I start at 7, 8, 6, 9, if you're a banker. You know, whatever the case may be, I'm out at 3, 4, 5, and I know my limit. I know I'm going to be here, I got to be here this long, and then I can get out of here. He says, as a servant earnestly desires the shadow, and as a hireling looks for the reward of his work, because the servant who worked out in the field in his day, nobody was wearing a wristwatch, they watched the sun, and when it got to a certain point, they knew they were paid every day as they did the work. At the end of the day, they get the wages for what they'd done. So they were looking for the sun to go down so they could finally get their wages and be done working. I mean, isn't that what you want? You sit in the office and at some point you start watching the clock. If you're a student, you sit in class and you just watch that clock go tick, tick. If they are nice enough to put one in your room, or they always would put one behind me. I don't know. So the teacher could watch the clock, but you couldn't watch it. Like, that was fair. But you could hear it tick, 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 and you'd keep doing the over-the-shoulder, looking for the time when your sentence was up, basically. Well, he says, so am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me. Months. This has been going on for months. I don't like pussy, wormy boils in months to be anywhere in the same vicinity when it's speaking about me. Wearisome nights, no rest. He says, when I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be gone? And I am full of tossings to and fro until the dawning of the day. My flesh is clothed with worms and clods of dust. My skin is broken and become loathsome. You know what it's like in the summertime? We've probably, some of you guys have experienced it, I know, recently. We just had the first couple real nice days of summer, and so you go out in the sun and you stay there way too long because you just don't bother to put on anything. You're not thinking about it. And you get that sunburn. You know the really bad one you get on your back, and then you try to sleep at night, and it's like you're on fire. You can't get comfortable. And when you can't get comfortable, you can't find a comfortable spot. You can't sleep. And so you're miserable. You wake up the next day, and then you're sore and you're cranky. Well, imagine being covered with boils from head to toe, no way to get comfortable, and no end in sight. Your suntan or your burn is not going to fade in a few days. Well, your sunburn will, but the boils are not. And there's no NyQuil in Job's day. He's got no prescription for OxyContin. He's got, you know, there's no whatever your drug of choice is. You can't OD on ibuprofen, none of that. He's just dealing with it. Become loathsome. It even stinks. It's rotting away. He says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Have you ever seen anybody weave before with a loom? You know, you've got all of the threads stretched out on this loom, and then they take the shuttle and they weave one across, and then they run the loom to pack it in, and then they weave it back the other, and the shuttle just goes back and forth. The word that says without hope there, it's kind of a play on words because the word hope means cord or thread. So it's like somebody is weaving, his days are just going on and on back and forth, but it's like they're moving that shuttle back and forth and there's no thread on it, so it's never getting anywhere. It's never going to be finished because they're not running any thread through there. And so this guy is just watching day after day go back and forth in front of his face with no hope. He says, oh, remember that my life is wind. Mine eye shall no more see good. The eye of him that has seen me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, I am not. As the clouds are consumed and vanish away, so he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. He says, my life is like wind. Like James says, it's like a vapor. It just burns off like a mist. It seems like it's there for a moment, like that fog early in the morning in the summer, and then as soon as the sun comes out, it's just gone. Life is like that. And Job says, you know, I'm dying here. It's basically what he says. I'm dying, God. God, I'm dying. And if I die, that's it. There's no coming back. You don't go visit death. You go and die. I don't go back to my home anymore, Lord. You're killing me here. I know maybe you guys can't ever sympathize with having cried out to God and saying, God, I'm dying here. Don't you understand? I mean, this is really it. I'm going down for the third time. I don't feel anybody underneath me. This is it. Therefore, I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. I got to say something because I'm dying, and there's, I can't hold my tongue anymore. He says, am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? What he's saying to God is, am I so scary that you have to be on me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Can't you give me a break from this? When I say, my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest with me with dreams and terrifiest me through visions. You know, I start thinking, well, at least I'll get a little bit of sleep and I can escape for a few hours. No, because as soon as I close my eyes, you give me nightmares. You know, and, you know, if you've got a bunch of infected sores all over your body, you're going to be feverish. And so, I don't know, my wife, my daughter, you give especially my daughter a fever, and she'll wake up in the middle of the night and come downstairs and, but I saw you know, I'm back upstairs because it just does something with her mind. And you know how that, if you've ever been in that place, you get, like, you see people who have malaria or whatever that have bad fevers. Job is in that place, so he's having crazy night terrors. He can't sleep. This is how bad it is, verse 15. So that my soul chooses strangling in death rather than life. I loathe it. I would not live always. Let me alone for my days of vanity. Job has gotten to a place where he's sitting around and he's thinking, I'd rather die than do this. In fact, let me think of the different ways I could die. How about drowning? Yeah, drowning would be better than this. How about strangling? Let me think of the worst death. How about burned alive? I mean, that's where Job is. He's contemplating different forms of death, and he says those are the painful, agonizing deaths I could think of would be better than living like this. He says, what is man that thou should magnify him and that thou should set thine heart upon him? It's funny because this sounds so much like that psalm that says, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou should visitest him? You've made him a little lower than the angels. But, and it's, you know, the messianic one. But here Job is saying, he's not saying that like, I can't believe that you would care about me, like that psalm says. What he's saying is, who am I that you are paying so much attention to me that you have to hammer me 24 hours a day? If you've ever seen the movie out there called Defiance, it's about a group of Jewish men who were hiding out in the woods during World War II and resisting the Nazis. And I'm beyond recommending movies because there's probably something in there to offend you, so don't watch it if you're easily offended. But at one point, there's a guy who's playing the rabbi, and there with a bunch. All these people are flocking to him for protection, and there's a bunch of kids there, and he's sitting down with them, and the rabbi is praying and basically asking God, I know we're your chosen people. Could you please choose someone else? I mean, we're tired of being chosen. Job is pretty much saying the same thing. He says, Who am I that you should magnify me, you should set your heart upon me, that you should visit him every morning and try him every moment? You're always on me. How long wilt thou not depart from me a little, or let me alone till I swallow down my spittle? Can I just swallow once? Can I just catch my breath? It's like you're on me so much, I don't even have time to swallow before you're hitting me again. This is how he thinks God is treating him. He says, I have sinned, what shall I do unto thee? And you could read that, if I have sinned, what shall I do unto thee? O thou preserver of men, why hast thou set me as a mark against thee, so that I am a burden to myself? It's like, okay, if I've sinned, what could I possibly do, God, to offend you this badly? I don't get it, Lord. What did I do? This is the same thing. His friends are saying, you've sinned. This is Job crying out to God, saying, God, if I've sinned, what did I do to make you this mad? And why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now shall I sleep in the dust, and thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. Okay, well, if I did sin, why haven't you forgiven me? Obviously, he sacrificed. Obviously, he's done everything that he could think of according to the law as he knew it to be forgiven by God. But this stuff doesn't go away, so he figures he's not. And he says, if it doesn't stop soon, I'm going to die. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite. Small man, Bildad. Bildad the Shuhite. Come on, wake up. I mean, that's a joke, all right? He's not a small man. It's just, he's really blunt. Eliphaz at least threw a word or two in the beginning to try to be gracious. Bildad, nah, not so much. Bildad says, how long will you speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? How long are you going to be a windbag, Job? Does God pervert judgment? Doth the Almighty pervert justice? What? God's righteous judge. Do you think he's going to let you pass on your sin, Job? That's what he's saying. Do you think he's going to let you get away with it? If your children have sinned against him, and he have cast them away for their transgression. Your kids died because they deserved it, and they had it coming, Job. That's why they died. Deal with it. Isn't the grace and the love flowing? This is his friend. Imagine if Job's enemies came. I mean, the only words this poor guy has had is from his wife who said, curse God and die, and then three friends who were telling him, your kids died because they deserved it. Nice friends. If thou would seek unto God betimes and make thy supplication to the Almighty, because obviously you haven't prayed and repented yet, Job, if thou were pure and upright, surely he would awake for thee and make thy the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Though thy beginning was small, yet thy latter end should greatly increase. If you were innocent, Job, he wouldn't be punishing you. For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to search of the fathers. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, because of our days on the earth are a shadow. Shall not they teach thee and tell thee and utter words out of their heart? He says, well, you should go back and look at history, because our life is so brief. We should look at the wisdom of the fathers. Now, the fact that Bildad is saying that is interesting because Job lives to be 200 years old. He's in the time of, you know, Abraham or earlier, and yet Bildad is saying, you know, our lives, they're just a vapor. They go by so quick. You should look at the really old guys, you know, Methuselah and Noah. Noah lived to be, what, 900 years old. Well, he's saying if you look back to them, you'd realize that's how it works, that God punishes the wicked and he saves the righteous, right? Which is funny because if you go back and you look at Noah in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, before the flood, it says, God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. God looks down at the world and he sees men are wicked and all they do is think about evil. Then in verse 8 of Genesis 6, it says, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Noah received unmerited favor. Then there's the flood, and everybody but Noah, his wife, and his three sons and their wives get wiped out in the flood. So there's only 8 people left on the earth. And in Genesis chapter 8, Noah gets off the boat, and he sacrifices. It says, Noah built an altar unto the Lord, took of every clean beast, of every clean fowl, offered a burnt offering to the Lord. The Lord smelled the sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. There's only Noah and his three sons left, and God's still saying, the ones who are left, yeah, they're still evil and wicked too. But they found grace. I mean, the friend who was saying, you should go back and check with history, if he had looked at the old fathers, he'd have realized it doesn't work like you think. It's grace that God gives us. It's not because people are, you know, Noah wasn't rewarded for being righteous. He received grace in the eyes of the Lord. He continues going on in verse 11. He says, can the rush grow up without mire? Can the flag grow without water? Cause and effect, Job. Can punishment come if there isn't sin for it to grow in? That's what he's saying. Whilst it's yet in its greenness and not cut down, it withers before any herb. So are the paths of all that forget God, and the hypocrite's hope shall perish. Thanks, buddy. Whose hope shall be cut off, and whose trust shall be a spider's web. He shall lean upon his house, but it shall not stand. He shall hold it fast, but it shall not endure. You know, sin brings punishment. The guy will have nothing to stand on who's a sinner. He is green before the sun, and his branch shoots forth in his garden. His roots are wrapped about the heap, and he sees the place of stones. If he destroy him from his place, then it shall deny him, saying, I have not seen these. He's saying, look, the wicked look prosperous, they start to bud and grow, and it doesn't matter if they're like a plant that wraps its roots around rocks or drops a real deep tap root. When the Lord decides to rip them out of there, they're going to perish, and you won't even know that they were there before. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the earth shall others grow. See, because he's going to rip the bad plants out like you, Job, and he's going to replace them with righteous ones like me. Behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers, till he fills thy mouth with laughing and thy lips with rejoicing. They that hate thee shall be clothed with shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked shall come to nothing. Prosperity 101, Job. God blesses the good, he punishes the wicked. You're being punished, therefore, you must be wicked. That's how it works. You look at it backwards. Well, you can't look at it backwards, because sometimes bad stuff happens to people not because of how they've performed, but because the Lord is allowing something in their life to prove them, which is what we know from hearing the behind-the-scenes stuff with Job, but they don't, and so they're looking at Job's life and figuring this is a result of his sin. I just want to go a few verses into chapter 9. We're not doing it all. Job answered and said, I know it's so of a truth. It's okay. I agree with your premise. God punishes sin, and he rewards righteousness. But how should man be just with God? What he's saying is, okay, if that's true, what more could I do to be righteous with him? Because you guys all know, if God is and we know it from behind the scenes what God was saying, God from his own mouth said that Job was blameless before him. He did whatever the law was required of him to be upright and be forgiven of his sins. He was sacrificing often. And you know he continued to sacrifice after this stuff happened, and he asked for forgiveness. Job's saying, okay, if that's true, what else do I have to do to be justified by God? if he will contend with him, he cannot answer him one of a thousand. You know, if I tried to argue with him, how could I argue with God? Now, that's his problem, is he wants to argue with God, and he's going to end up repenting of this by the time we get to chapter 42. Because he's questioning the fairness of God. He says, he is wise in heart, mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and has prospered? Which removeth the mountains, and they know not. Which overturn them in anger. Which shakes the earth out of her place as the pillars thereof tremble, which commandeth the sun and rises not, and seals up the stars. See, Job understands that God is awesome, okay? Job can see the stars like we can see the stars. Job understands God is a powerful God, that he can't be, you know, man is not God, and that he's so far above man. But for Job's not comforted by the fact that God is that big, because Job is questioning God's fairness and his goodness. That's what the whole thing, I want to contend with him. Because Job thinks he's getting a raw deal. Because he's done everything he's supposed to do. And a strong and an awesome and a powerful God is a great comfort if you trust him completely. But if you start to think, yeah, but maybe he's arbitrary. And maybe he just wipes people out because he feels like wiping people out. The strength of God becomes a fearful thing. You know, in Hebrews chapter 11, it says that without faith it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. You've got to come to God with the understanding that God is good. That's like the baseline. The baseline is you got to believe he is. You got to believe in a God. If you don't believe there's a God at all, well, then there's not much we can help you with there until you do. But if you do believe there is a God, you have to believe that he's good for those people who seek him. And if you ever get to the place where you're questioning, well, is God good? How do I know he's a good God? Well, Romans 5:8, God demonstrates his love towards us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. If you ever question about whether or not God's a good God or not, ask yourself, how many sins had you done before he sent Jesus to die for your sins? The fact that he was willing to send his son to take the punishment that you deserve, it shows that he's fair, he's righteous. But Job is questioning that. He goes on about God. He says, which alone spreads out the heavens and treads upon the waves of the sea, which makes Arcturus, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. I mean, Job has seen enough of the sky, and he doesn't have a Hubble telescope or a wonderful website where you can see all the pictures to know how awesome outer space is. I was looking at something earlier today about the sun. Our sun's pretty awesome, right? I mean, it provides the warmth we need. Sometimes too much warmth, but it provides all the warmth we need, all the rays to keep our planet from dying. I mean, all the energy that's on our planet comes from the sun, basically. It's huge. I mean, when you think about it, what is it, 1.3 million Earths could fit inside of the sun. It's a big ball of gas. It's a pretty simple thing, though. It's huge, but it's only got helium, hydrogen, a little bit of nitrogen, and then a few trace elements. That's it. It's just this huge ball of gas, and then he lit it off with fusion, and it just goes. The energy produced by the sun is the equivalent of a trillion megaton bombs going off every second. That's a lot of juice coming out of the sun. But you think about the sun, and it's just hung in the sky for you. It's not the most complex thing that God ever did. Yeah, you know what I think the most complex thing that God made is? And, you know, the stars are in our sun is a small sun, there's huge suns, there's Betelgeuse, and there's all these other ones that dwarf our sun. But what are there, a few elements in the sun? It's a big ball of gas, you light it off, and away it goes. I mean, it's awesome that it's up there and it's hanging in space. I think you and I are way more awesome than the sun. I mean, you look at the next thing he says, which doeth great things past finding out, yea, wonders without number. We sit about 93 million miles from the sun. 93 million miles. You turn on the light from the sun, takes 8 minutes to get here and back, right? 8 minutes to get here from the sun. You You guys know enough science, high school science, junior high science, whatever, to know that your body is comprised of cells, and every one of your cells has DNA in it, right? Which is a little thread of information, basically. Looks like, well, you know, the I forget what the name of the structure is. Crick. I can remember the guys who, why is it I can remember the double helix? There you go. Double helix, two strands tied together of information. Crick and Watson discovered the thing. If you took, and this, in each body, there's somewhere around, depends on who you ask, anywhere from 50 to 100 trillion cells in your body. It's a lot of cells, right? I mean, some of us have a few more cells than others, but roughly 50, 75, 100 trillion cells, somewhere in there. If you were to take the DNA out of all of your cells and group it all together, it would fit in a space about the size of an ice cube, right? That's pretty reasonable. But if you were to take all of the strands of DNA in your body and you were to tie them end to end that way, it would be long enough to almost do 70 round trips to the sun. Just in you. 70 round trips, 93 million miles and back, 70 times, just taking the information in your body and going end to end in it. One of the things that I've been trying to figure out, I've been reading some stuff lately about DNA and cell structure and how, because I'm weird, and how the body works together. I get DNA, okay? We have this digital code in every one of our cells that tells us how we are to be made. It contains all the information necessary to build us. When you are first conceived, one sperm, one egg, get together, boom, mix of mom's DNA, dad's DNA, new piece of DNA, and that DNA describes what you're going to be. And then that little cell starts a splitting, and it goes from one cell to two cells with identical copies of the DNA in both, absolutely the same. In fact, we know that if we take those clump of two cells and we separate them, they will grow into two twins, right, that are very, very similar. But those two cells, when they're linked together there, they're exactly the same. And then they both split. Boom, now you got four, now you get eight, now you get 16, 32. It starts to go like that. Every one of those cells has the exact same DNA in it. But somewhere down the road, something happens. And the cells begin what's called cellular differentiation, also known as, depending, autonomous specification, where the cells decide, I'm going to be a blood vessel cell. And another cell will decide, I'm going to be a liver cell. Now, you think about what that means for just a minute. In fact, your body has a plan, right? And as it begins to develop and grow, at some point there's the basic layout where I'm going to have a liver inside my gut somewhere. And in order to have a liver, I need to have blood and blood vessels and everything to supply that liver. So before the liver starts to form, the blood vessels start to form in the body and all of the necessary structure to support my liver form. And then when the stuff is there, then the liver forms and it all starts to function. The question is, how does that happen? Did you ever wonder that? Because every cell has the same DNA in it. If one cell is the building material, and this cell could be anything. It could be a lung cell, could be a skin cell, could be a toenail cell, whatever. But they somehow decide. It's like I'm doing an addition on my house, and I have a pile of lumber out there. Okay? And the lumber could be anything. The lumber could be the cabinets. The lumber could be the floor. The lumber could be the walls. And the DNA basically makes up the lumber. But where is the blueprint stored? Because what happens with the materials is completely dependent upon the mind of the designer and the guy who is putting everything together. And you read the scientific literature and you ask the question, where does that come from? And they can tell you, well, we know at certain points some of the genes decide to become certain types of cells. And we know that if you pluck them out after they've decided, like if these ones are going to be eye cells and you pluck out one of the eye cells, then the creature will, whatever the thing is that they're messing with, will grow into a creature and it won't have an eye. But what is it that makes it decide to be an eye? Well, we know that there are certain genes that get turned on. But what does that? Well, but we know there are certain genes and that, I mean, the answer is we don't know because all of them have the same DNA. And who is deciding? I mean, is there like a meeting? Is there like a group, focus group where all of the cells get together and say, who's in favor of becoming, you know, who wants to take the job of being a liver? No, it just happens. Well, I think I know where it just happens. Psalm 139 says this, verse 13. Thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knows right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought on the lower parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when there yet was none of them. In other words, you made all my stuff, and you fashioned them before everything was there. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God, how great is the sum of them. Job says the things that God can do are past finding out. You and I, the design of us, is past finding out. They're wonders without number. The problem is Job, because of what he was going through with the suffering, it wasn't a comfort to him. He says in verse 11, lo, he goes by me and I see him not. He passes on also, but I perceive him not. Behold, he takes away. Who can hinder him? Who will say unto him, what doest thou? He can punch anyone's ticket anytime he wants, and who is it who can argue with God? If God will not withdraw his anger, the proud helpers do stoop under him. He can't resist him. How much less shall I, who's very weak at this point, answer him and choose out my words and reason with him? Who, though I were righteous, yet would I not answer, but I would make supplication to my judge. I wouldn't even dare to contend with him. If I had called and he had answered me, yet would I not believe that he had hearkened unto my voice. If I did call out to him and he answered, I don't think I'd even believe that he really answered me, is what Job's saying. And yet, Romans tells us that whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. Don't we do that sometimes? We cry out to God for something over and over and over again, and then it actually happens, and we say, was that really you, God? Really, you answered me? I can't believe it. No, it must have been a coincidence. When something bad happens, it's an act of God. When something good happens, it must be a coincidence. We know better than Job knew. We know that if we call to him, he will answer us. And that many are his thoughts towards us, beyond finding out, as many as the sand on the seashore. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much, Father, that you are a good God. You're merciful. Lord, thank you that Job got to learn this lesson and we can take it as a correspondence course. Father, I pray you would forgive us for the times when we doubt you. Help us to trust in you. And Lord, we look forward to the day when we see you face to face and all questions are answered. And as the song we sing says, when our faith become our eyes. Lord, we look forward to that day. Come quickly, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.